If you've ever thought of the environmentalist movement as just some, some young kids who like to spend time in the great outdoors and want to protect our streams from industrial waste, folks, think again. In their own words, leading environmentalists talk of the hundreds of millions of dollars they've spent and the gargantuan network of hardball political organizations they've created to push an agenda. If you remember nothing else of this hour, would you please remember that this whole environmentalist, whatever you want to call it, it does have an agenda. Christians are playing into it. Christians are spreading it, and we'll get more detailed about that in just a moment. The place I like to go for truth concerning this topic, and that would be the Cornwall Alliance, and it would be, hold on a minute here, it would be the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Now, this is a network of clergy, theologians, religious leaders, scientists, economists, policy experts, but they are committed to bringing, and here's the key word, a balanced biblical view of stewardship to the critical issues of environment and development. And now this, I believe, was formed about 5 years ago, and it is the leading evangelical voice on environmental stewardship. Over 500 people, all sorts of walks of life, have signed on to this. Dr. Calvin Beissner happens to be the chief spokesman, but others who are a part of it, at least by way of signature, hundreds. Randy Alcorn, David Barton, Dr. Gary Cass, Reverend Peter Jones, the late Dr. James Kennedy, Terry Mortensen from Answers in Genesis, David Noble, Summit Ministries, Tony Perkins, Family Research Council. And basically, what are they all saying? They're basically saying, yes, please have respect for God's creation while not falling into the trap of deifying the ecology movement. And that is what we see a lot of today, deifying in minor ways and in major ways, deifying the ecology movement. My guest this hour is Dr. Calvin Beissner. Cal, welcome to Understanding the Times.
Jan, thanks a whole lot. I know you have a lot of respect for example, for Dr. David Noble of Summit Ministries.
I do.
And David Wheaton out there, right
yes.
nearby you. You know, we have something very much in common there. I've taught many, many years at Summit Ministries and really enjoyed it. And they do provide the worldview foundations
mm-hmm.
for a lot of young people that should help them to think through these issues, because in an awful lot of ways, the difficulties, the errors of the green movement, the environmentalist movement, stem from a failure to think through carefully the worldview questions. As an example, the basic assumption behind almost all environmentalist thought is that the earth is a very, very fragile
yeah.
place. And so we have to tread very, very lightly or we'll cause, you know, irreversible damage.
Well, can I play off of that, Cal, for just a moment here?
Because
I think this is so important. Right now I'm quoting you, oil, oil everywhere, but not a drop
yes.
to capture. Will we hear environmentalists who so love the earth and its ecosystem celebrating how marvelously the Gulf ecosystem is solving its own problems, largely without our help? Or will they just quietly leave this great irreversible catastrophe that wasn't and move on to the next one? Cal
yeah.
Beissner, help us understand what has happened, because we have heard since April 20th, and that's several months ago, of the millions and millions and millions of gallons of crude oil spilled into the Gulf, and all of a sudden it is now just sort of disappearing.
Yeah. Well, oil is a biodegradable product. There are microorganisms throughout the seas that consume oil. They grow on it. And what actually happens when you have a major oil leak like this is that you suddenly get a great bloom of these microorganisms,
mm-hmm.
which means in turn a bloom for whatever it is that feeds on them and whatever feeds on that and whatever feeds on it in turn. Now, that doesn't mean that we should be calloused and think, oh, no big deal if you get an oil spill. But what it does mean is that we recognize that God has engineered into his ecosystems ways that problems get corrected just naturally by mm-hmm. the way God has designed it. Another problem on the Gulf oil spill was that very few people ever really stopped to do the math and get the proportions right. You know, people were shocked starting a little over a week ago when they found that it was really difficult to find any oil mm-hmm. anywhere in the water, on the surface, even on the beaches and whatnot. It was very difficult to find the oil, and they're thinking, what happened to all this oil? Well, suppose that all the oil leaked, about 200 million gallons, suppose that all the oil leaked was confined to a cylinder of the water above the wellhead, 5 miles in radius. The wellhead was at about 5,000 feet. If you do the math from that, what you find is that oil would constitute about 24/10,000 of 1% of all the water in that cylinder. Now, that's pretty tiny. That's not much, and it's very difficult to isolate 24/10,000 of 1% of anything.
Right, but in the process of what we're talking about, we are not putting down some of the real suffering that has gone on.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the greatest tragedy, of course, was the loss of the 11 lives mm-hmm. in the explosion on the rig up, you know, on the surface. That was a huge tragedy. Those were human beings created in God's image, sacred, with a right to life, vitality. That was the greatest tragedy. And then there have been indeed some ecological damages in various places, especially in marshes along the coasts where it's most difficult to clean up what has happened. But frankly, the ecological damages repair themselves quite quickly.
Well, what you say, Cal, again, I'm just interjecting. This is under the category on your website of what we believe and what we deny. And the first thing you believe is we believe the earth and its ecosystems created by God's intelligent design and infinite power and sustained by his faithful providence are robust, resilient, self-regulating, and self-correcting.
Yeah.
Admirably suited for human flourishing and the displaying of his glory. And I think the one question you raise here that we haven't hit yet, how many are praising God for his design of the earth that enables it to recover so well? As a matter of fact, how many are even praising God more specifically to the fact that this horrific incident, which began in April, is pretty much over.
Yeah.
But that's not the point.
Yeah.
It's over, and the ecology is being restored as we speak.
Yeah, that's correct, and you're right. Not many people are praising God for that, and they should be. There's wonderful resilience in God's creation. Most of the environmentalist movement starts out with the assumption that Earth is a result of chance processes over time. There is no God, or if there is a God, he didn't design the whole thing. Maybe God is the Earth. But they start out with this assumption of chance as the reason for the Earth's being here. And, hey, what comes about by chance might just well be obliterated by chance
mm-hmm.
as well. That's not a biblical understanding, and as Christians, we want to approach these matters with a biblical understanding. Now, what you were quoting from there was our Evangelical Declaration on Global Warming that people can see at cornwallalliance.org. And this matter, this worldview issue, really applies there, too, because the whole assumption behind dangerous, man-made global warming is that a tiny, tiny change in atmospheric chemistry, carbon dioxide going from 28/1000 of a percent to 54,000ths of a percent of the atmosphere can cause devastating warming that can, even as Al Gore puts it, just destroy human civilization. That kind of thinking doesn't make sense. Imagine that an architect designs a building, and he designs it so that if you lean on one wall, all the feedback mechanisms in that building magnify the impact of your leaning on that wall so that the whole building collapses. Does anybody think, oh, what a wonderful architect, what a genius? No, they think, boy, that was pretty stupid.
Yeah.
God declared at the end of Genesis chapter 1, when he had created all things, he looked at all, and behold, it was very good. I don't think that's consistent with thinking that a tiny change in atmospheric chemistry is going to cause devastating global warming, or for that matter, devastating global cooling. I think instead God has made it so that the climate, it goes in cycles up and down, but it cycles around a very temperate, very, very livable mean, and that's what we've been seeing.
Right, I think cycling. I think, Cal Beisner, the sad end of this story, and of course the greatest is loss of lives and loss of businesses and things like that since last April or so.
Yeah.
But there's another message here, and that is the fact that this oil spill was politicized.
Absolutely.
And the fact that the damage was great at its worst. And we have to go back to the administration's comment, which was made early on, almost the first few days or weeks of the Obama administration, that they never want to let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
And so in this case, the politicization of this tragedy was to suspend offshore drilling and things like that.
Yeah.
To me, that is another tragedy. We've got loss of life. We've got loss of jobs. We've got loss of animals down there. We've had this predicament politicized, which it never should have been.
Yeah. Just in terms of the monetary damage done, the administration's response by imposing a moratorium on offshore drilling and by shutting down the fishing industry, for instance, when there never was any evidence that any of the shellfish, the shrimp, the other fish being caught in the Gulf were contaminated in any way that was dangerous to anyone. Shutting all that stuff down, basically closing down a huge part of the entire economy of the Gulf Coast, that did far more damage economically than the oil itself did. And it's going to continue to do damage already, just simply because of the unpredictable situation of regulation of oil drilling in the Gulf. Already, major deep water drilling rigs have left the Gulf and headed for Brazil, for the coast off of Nigeria and other places. It's extremely expensive to move those things. People are not going to move them back into our Gulf area until they are confident that they're not going to just have another moratorium slapped on them. This means the loss of thousands and thousands of jobs along the Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida Gulf coasts. That's far more damaging than what the oil itself did.
Yeah, help us understand, what are these little microorganisms that actually eat oil? I mean, God made them, and God apparently made them because he knew these kinds of accidents were going to happen. So we've got little creatures swimming around down there, literally eating oil.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of different species of them, but they're all, as you say, microorganisms. They're not even something that you can see without at least a magnifying glass, perhaps a microscope in some instances. But they literally live at every level of the water in the Gulf, from thousands of feet down right up to the surface, and they simply ingest oil. They turn the carbon of the oil into cell fiber, cell material. And then those things in turn are eaten by slightly larger organisms, which are eaten by larger ones, which are eaten by fish, which are eaten by people. So actually, it's a good thing. And the Gulf itself, the Gulf of Mexico particularly, is rich in these precisely because all the time there is oil leaking up through the floor of the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Not from anything that we've done, but just simply from natural geological formations. And in fact, our drilling for oil in the Gulf can reduce the amount of oil that is leaked into the waters over the long haul because we reduce the pressure in the underlying oil pools, and therefore we reduce the rate of the flow of oil up through natural geological fissures in the sea floor. So, you know, what we're doing by bringing that oil up and then turning it into usable energy for gasoline and diesel for our cars and trucks and that sort of thing, that not only serves human needs very well, it also serves the ecological quality of the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, so we've hit on this politicization of everything. And here's the thing that first of all, I found it very, very intriguing that the BP, British Petroleum, actually are the darlings of the green movement. BP is supposed to really stand for Beyond Petroleum. And so they polish their green image, but in the process, they apparently cut off one of their safety issues on the Deepwater Horizon. Has that been proven, Cal?
I've seen a lot of claims back and forth on that. I think we need to wait till the end of official investigations of exactly how this happened. There does appear to be some evidence that they may have left out one element of their multi-level safety precautions in the drilling and the piping of this well. That's not, I think, quite positive yet, and we really need to wait, I think, for official investigations to be done. It's just too early to say. What you have got, I think, right on target is that BP went out of its way, spending literally millions of dollars
mm-hmm.
over the last several years to create an image of an environmentally responsible company. What's interesting is to find out in the budgets of companies like this, and there are many other companies around the world that have been doing the same thing, where in the budget does the money for that sort of thing come from? It comes almost invariably in the marketing part of the budget. It's PR. In other words, it's not in the parts of the budget that are for research and development. It's not in the parts of the budget that are for the acquisition of machinery or raw materials or paying laborers to actually produce product. And what that tells us is that the so-called green economy is basically an economy of window dressing. The things that are pushed to be done because they're green tend not to be profitable. If they were profitable,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't need to be pushed because profit-seeking people would be doing them. But that's just the case. For example, with wind energy, for example, nowhere does wind energy pay for itself. Everywhere it's got to be subsidized by money taken away from taxpayers, by governments, and given to those who produce the wind energy. Now, that tells you immediately, if you know any economics at all, that the wind energy is an unprofitable thing,
no.
that it cannot sustain itself, and that it wouldn't exist if it weren't for the subsidies. So BP tried very hard to create an image, a public image, of a green company, but nonetheless, oil, drilling for oil, continued to be way over 99% of all its revenues. Well, that's not Beyond Petroleum. That's still basically petroleum.
Yeah. You know, and I think that this has been quite a boon for environmentalists, this whole situation that began last April, quite a boon for environmentalists. And I think many think that it's going to lead to this cap and trade policy, which is a huge, huge energy tax, and which could add as much as $1,200 a year to the average American family, or even double that to the average American family.
Even triple this cap and trade.
Now, cap and trade kind of got put on the back burner in the last few weeks. Do you think that it's going to come back out, raise its ugly head? And I really mean ugly.
Yeah, I think that's a real interesting political question. After Congress comes back from recess in September, there are a number of different things that are on the agenda to try to get done. Cap and trade seems, at least among most of the pundits, to be dead for this year.
Yes.
I wouldn't count it out for sure. There's too much risk. One possible scenario is that the Senate manages to pass any kind of an energy bill, even something very small and insignificant, and then it puts that bill together with the House Waxman-Markey bill that was passed in July of last year, and they send the two into conference for reconciliation, and with no more than a 50% vote in the Senate instead of a 60% vote, you can wind up with the whole Waxman-Markey package getting passed. So
okay.
I think taxpayers need to realize that the danger is not over on cap and trade.
Well, good. I'm glad you clarified that. Mm-hmm. Because I believe you're the one who told me that cap and trade could actually raise the federal debt $116,000 per family
and do
nothing to reduce climate issues, and therefore it's all pain and no gain. That's quoting you there.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, the figures come from a study done, an economic modeling study done for the Heritage Foundation by one of the major economic modeling research groups. But those are pretty typical figures. The Manhattan Institute, I think, did a study that came to basically the same results. Essentially what you get is if Waxman-Markey, the cap-and-trade bill that passed the House in July of last year, were to be implemented as law, it would raise the average household's direct energy costs by about $1,200 a year, and indirect energy costs, which is the energy component of the price of everything that we buy, since everything that we buy gets made and transported with energy, by about another $2,400 a year, a combined $3,600 a year.
And does that include a raise in gas prices?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Gas prices would go up. Electricity prices would skyrocket, which is exactly what Obama promised during his campaign for the presidency. He said, under my administration, electricity prices would skyrocket because he intended to try to eliminate the use of coal for generating electricity in this country and replace it all with solar and wind. Well, wind is at least twice as expensive as coal for producing electricity. Solar tends to run about eight times as expensive. So obviously, if you're going to replace coal with those, you're going to skyrocket the electricity prices. And at the same time, because all these energy prices go shooting up, you're increasing the cost of doing business, which means that you're going to disemploy a lot of people. And the studies indicate that in the average year, from 2012 to 2035, there would be about 1.1 million fewer people employed than there would have been otherwise. And in fact, it starts out a little lower, and it rises and rises. By 2035, there are an extra 2.5 million people unemployed just because of that legislation, if it were to be implemented.
Cal, I want to move into this resisting the green dragon because it is so important. And you launched this April 20th, 2010, and apparently the Cornwall Alliance asserts that one of the greatest threats to society and the church is the multifaceted environmentalist movement, and there isn't an aspect of life that it doesn't seek to force into its own mold. Help us understand, who is the Green Dragon, and why particularly churches should be resisting the Green Dragon?
Thanks, Jan. you know, we're really very excited about this new initiative. This is the largest project we've ever taken on. What do we mean by the green dragon? Well, we don't mean, you know, little old ladies who like to go out and garden.
Yes.
We don't mean young people who like to go out and clean up stream beds, or even people who are protesting the dumping of toxic waste into streams. I mean, those are all good things to do. The green dragon is the environmentalist movement as it has grown up over the last 30 to 40 years. It has left behind its roots in conservationism, which was basically the belief that we should use the resources that we find in the earth in a wise way so that we serve our fellow men with them and so that we ensure that future generations also will be able to meet their own needs. That was a very wise and good attitude. But the environmentalist movement has left that behind, and it's now dominated by two basic worldviews, a secularist, atheistic worldview, and a pantheistic, Eastern, pagan worldview. And in both instances, humanity turns out to be denigrated. We are of no greater value than any other life form. And you wind up with the movements for animal rights, with movements for ecosystem rights. I mean, the Swiss Constitution has recently been changed to recognize plant rights. And now it's illegal for you to harvest a field of wheat in a way that would be somehow insulting to the integrity of the wheat.
Yeah, I know it stretches credulity sometimes, and I know you say environmentalism has become a new religion.
Yes.
And you say its policies are devastating to the world's poor. It's threatening the sanctity of human life. It targets our youth, and its vision is global. And more and more and more, we keep hearing about global government. Everything wants to go global, be a one-world system, which, of course, the Bible does talk about.
What many people don't realize is that most environmentalist organizations are also right in bed with the anti-population growth movement, and they want to promote totally free access to abortion and euthanasia, essentially killing off old or handicapped people, and eugenics as means of trying to reduce human population because they see people as fundamentally consumers and polluters, instead of recognizing that because God made us in his image and he is a creator, we are meant to be creative, productive stewards of this earth. And in fact, God told us in Genesis 1:28 to multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over it, which means that in God's plan, earth is not best untouched by human hands. Nature does not know best. Those are two basic ideas of the environmentalist movement. Rather, God intends the earth to be transformed by wise, godly human action as we learn the rules of God's word, as our minds are transformed by the renewing of the Holy Spirit through the Word of God, so that we can understand what is good and acceptable in God's sight. This is what we should be aiming at, and this is what the Cornwall Alliance promotes.
Sure. All right.
Biblical stewardship.
Yeah, but we do have environmental activists, and again, and thank you for stressing this, because they're pushing this terribly unbiblical message to the church, to the more liberal churches, but also to evangelicals, to conservative Christians. And apparently for several years, liberal churches have been doing such things as carbon fasting.
Oh, yes.
That sounds interesting. Observing carbon Lent, making other efforts to make the church relevant on Earth Day. And
yep.
Now groups on the evangelical side, and they may be heavily evangelical left, and they are working to bring a green gospel into the churches. And this is what concerns me. I expect some of the more liberal wing of the of denominations, whatever, I'm not going to fill in the blank of which ones, I expect them to be fasting for carbon Lent here. I do not expect the Evangelical Environmental Network to get on board with what some on the left are doing. But they are doing that, Cal Beisner.
Yes, they are. And in fact, it's not terribly surprising when you know the history of the evangelical environmental movement. It basically has been promoted especially by an organization called the Evangelical Environmental Network, and that, in turn, was birthed out of what was called the National Partnership for, the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, the NRPE. These were formed in the early 1990s, promoted especially by the late Carl Sagan, of Cosmos fame, the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be, a challenge to the existence of God, and a mocking of the Christian confession of faith that God is the one who is and who was and who is to come. Carl Sagan and James Parks Morton, the rector of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City, a very, very liberal Episcopal cathedral, where they have annual special services of dedicating animals to God. They baptize animals as people bring their animals there. They started this National Religious Partnership for the Environment with grants of millions of dollars from the Rockefeller Fund and other organizations that are longtime supporters of abortion, of population control, of radical environmentalist notions, and the Evangelical Environmental Network was one of the organizations spawned by this.
All right, just stop right there, because I think we want to understand the mindset of a conservative Christian backing the kinds of things you've just outlined. And I think you implied to me on the phone the other day that some of these evangelical and conservative Christians, they basically want to be seen as very caring and very concerned about some of these issues that we're talking about, but they have neglected really looking at the science. And for that matter, Dr. Cal Beisner, they apparently have neglected coming to someone like you for counsel.
Well, what's happened is that an awful lot of evangelicals have just accepted uncritically the scientific claims made by environmental lobbying organizations like Greenpeace, Sierra Club, World Wildlife Fund, and the like. And frankly, they are pretty fast and loose with their claims of fact. They grossly exaggerate many environmental problems. They have made some of them up out of whole cloth, just complete myths. And unfortunately, a lot of evangelicals seem to think that there's something uncompassionate about wanting to test such claims. But the Apostle Paul orders us in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things, hold fast what is good. And that's part of why the Cornwall Alliance has built intentionally a network of scientists and economists who have real expertise in these issues. You remember a few years ago, the Evangelical Environmental Network launched an initiative called the Evangelical Climate Initiative.
Oh, yes.
Remember that?
Very well.
And initially, it got signed by 86 evangelical college presidents and mission leaders and the like. And I looked at the list of the people who signed it, and there was nobody with expertise in the scientific or economic issues involved. And they didn't even tell us who actually wrote the document, as it turns out. I've still only been able to find one name of a person who actually wrote it, and that was an ethics professor, David Gushy, who also didn't have any expertise in the science or economics, and who, when he debated me about 8 months after they released the document, admitted to me before we went on the stage for the debate, you know, in preparing for this debate, I've found that the science is a whole lot more nuanced than I thought it was when I wrote the document.
I think there are some names, Cal, that have had some influence, such as a Jim Wallace. We've got Ron Sider, who made a huge impact with his Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger.
Right.
And there are some other names we could give. Actually, there are dozens and dozens that we could give. Here's the issue, though, is they're influencing millions. They're influencing millions who are sitting in the pews. They're getting some of these people's eyes off of more important salvation issues and turning their eyes towards conserving energy and saving the planet and things like that. And I always have to go back to the fact when we get down to saving the planet. I mean, the source of our ecological problem is in man's fallen nature.
Absolutely.
Because he has set himself at the center of the universe. We
yep.
are waiting for his return to make things right again. We do not need to sit in our evangelical and very conservative Christian churches. We do not need to sit in the pews and be told how to save energy and how to, and literally how to save the planet, because as we opened up, God is a marvelous protector of the planet. Again,
yeah.
folks, if you joined us late, we talked about the organisms in the ocean that actually eat up this oil. That's God's creation. That's God's way of protecting and preserving the earth. Christians, but the thing is, Cal, we still need to emphasize that we have been given some dominion over the earth, and we need to treat it right.
Yeah, we need to be good stewards. We're answerable to God. We don't want to be careless about things, but neither do we need to think that, you know, the earth is going to go to hell in a handbasket if we don't all become members of Greenpeace. That's just not the case. What's happened is that the especially the younger evangelical environmental movement folks have been heavily influenced by much older folks like Ron Sider, author of Rich Christians and an Age of Hunger, who have been pushing socialist, big government solutions to human problems for 40 years or more. And too many of the young people don't realize this is where this is coming from. The Evangelical Environmental Network that was started out of the National Religious Partnership on the Environment was actually under the auspices also of the Evangelicals for Social Action, which mm-hmm. is Ron Sider's organization. The president of it for many years, Jim Ball, is a longtime leftist who believes in government-forced redistribution of wealth and basically a leftist socialistic idea. Jim Wallace has
yep.
been promoting these things.
Cal Beissner, is socialism here the bottom line?
I wouldn't say it's the bottom line. I'd say it's an important part of the mixture.
All right.
Much of the motivation to get environmentally involved for many people, especially among secular environmentalists, has been their prior commitment to socialism. And here's the reason why. Socialism basically says we want government to control all of life. Environmentalism comes from the word environment, the root of which in French means surroundings. Everything is our surroundings. Environmentalism is fundamentally everythingism. And so if you want to control all of life, then you see environmentalism as a vehicle by which to promote that kind of thinking. And so then you start hearing about eco-justice and
mm-hmm.
environmental
mm-hmm.
justice. Those turn out to be the same thing as so-called social justice, which turns out to be redistribution of wealth, which is contrary to the biblical understanding of justice, as I pointed out in my own book, Prosperity and Poverty, The Compassionate Use of Resources in a World of Scarcity.
And man is not going to destroy the earth. Someday God will destroy the earth.